Radio.
Christopher Dawson's response to culture and religion in Christian Latin poetry. A presentation by Dr. Nora Leosis at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium.
Hello, everyone. It's good to be back in the university grounds, at least. Yes. I want to congratulate the organising committee for setting up such a wonderful event, which no doubt was very timely, from what I've heard this morning so far. Christopher Dawson, 1889 to 1970. Dawson's analysis of Christian Latin poetry is related to his holistic approach on religion, society, and culture in general. That is, quote, a strong living culture has to have a strong living religion because they rise and fall together. Indeed, nascent Christianity had embraced many poetic forms, like the exemplary Magnificat, an alluring literary text, now actually highly fashionable and workable for commentary and mimesis. However, this paper examines more specifically Dawson's critiques of leading Christian Latin poets from the 4th to the 6th centuries, with their orientation obviously distinct from that wider Latin literature expanded in the paganism of classical antiquity. Before the mid-3rd century, there was no definite trace of Latin Christian poetry, since the first Christian literature in the West was written wholly in Greek. The majority of the church at Rome were composed of Greek-speaking Christians, but Jewish in origin. Even so, the adoption of Latin was critical, as the language of Western Christianity and the influence of Tertullian and the language of Italy, Gaul, and Spain advanced Latin as the church's liturgical and literary language. Early hymnal poets of the 4th century consulted students to decipher mythological and historical allusions and grammatical usage. Latin fathers like the great Prudentius Clemens adapted Horace and Virgil as models, although the Vulgar Latin, which advanced Church Latin, was promoted by Gaius Vettius Juvencis, a noble Spaniard priest of Emperor Constantine. Juvencis argued comparatively that the continued success of Homer and classical poets surely validated even greater glory for literature written on Christ. In parentheses, a very smart argument that most people haven't heard about it, this equation. Dawson, meanwhile, notes quite logically that, quote, in every culture, men possess the powers of reasoning of speech, but the content of their reasoning depends on the culture to which they belong. Among every people, we find the figure of the inspired poet at the threshold of its literary tradition. That is, he's saying that every nation, every people will advance a spectacular, remarkable poet, Homer in the past, and then often contemporary poets today. Dawson also reiterated Christianity's rich tradition of language through liturgy. The Eastern term hymn defines a song of praise to the divine, as you all know, and was adapted for communal singing and worship in church. The Roman breviary's hymns and prayers were recited in divine office as short lyrical poems, actually, signifying hymns, and later the Middle Ages would consolidate this genre within liturgical history. Over time, Christian poets applying classical form moved away from the symbolism of pagan mythology and vernacular Christian poetry to embrace biblical allusions and Latin translations. Ambrose, the saintly scholar bishop, preacher of Milan, son of a Christian mother, was born in Roman Gaul. He consolidated the church in the late Roman Empire and converted Augustine of Hippo. His many hymns were treasured in the Western hymnaries until integrated permanently in the Roman office. Augustine's Confession, for example, testifies to Ambrose's winning poetic impact through song during Augustine's own personal struggles and his grief over Monica's demise. So Augustine, quote, "What tears," he said, "did I shed over the hymns and canticles when the sweet sound of the music of thy church thrilled my soul. As the music flowed into me and the tears ran down, there was gladness in those tears, for the bitterness of my sorrow could not be washed away from my heart." The Ambrosian hymn, Deus Creator Omnium, Creator of the Earth and Sky, which you have on your handouts, I think, is one of four hymns that Augustine verifies as Ambrose's composition. Augustine also points out another aspect of hymnody, in that the singing of hymns and psalms, as in the eastern provinces, relieved the weary faithful of the taxing nocturnal vigils and confessions. In this sense, Ambrose's hymns and Augustine's treatise enriched and vitalized Christian community practice. The remarkable Christian Latin scholar from Oxenbridge, the late Frederick Raby, notes that nearly all of the 41 hymns, although some say maybe 92 Ambrosian hymns, are not part of the office of Roman secular clergy. Taken together, though, Ambrose of Milan can rightly be regarded as the father of Catholic hymnody, because he created a school and tradition which found a permanent place in church liturgy. The hymns of Ambrose in the classical Demeter were written for congregational purposes and encouraged imitation. These enjoyed immense popularity, known collectively as the Hymni Ambrosiani. Ambrose's exclusive poetic form of liturgical hymnody used four verses of 2-foot lines comprised of 8 syllables. I'm just keeping it simple there, not the actual terms. St. Hilary, in Greek or Latin. St. Hilary, though, we shouldn't underestimate him. We tend to forget that he was the first hymnist in the West. But he took a different direction because he adopted Eastern church style, which was familiar to him during his sojourn in Asia Minor. Ambrose, though, was a realist on the function of hymns. Quote, "Everyone strives to confess their faith and know how to declare in verse on the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost." His hymns share verbal and technical correspondences, as does the familiar hymn, Veni Redemptor Gentium, Come Redeemer of the Nations. Another popular hymn is the evening compline hymn, sung daily, De Lucis Ante Terminum, Now That the Daylight Fades Away, which applies the meter and strophe typical of Ambrose. It remains one of his most beautiful hymns in the Roman office and reminds us, too, of the early Christians' wariness of dark nocturnal forces. Dawson notes that in St. Ambrose, above all, the Western Church found a leader who could maintain the rights of the Church, who was at the same time a loyal friend of the emperors and a devoted servant of the empire. Ambrose was indeed a Roman of the Romans, born and trained in the tradition of the imperial civil service, and he brought to the church the public spirit and devotion to duty. Ambrose, for Dawson, stands midway between the old classical ideal of civic responsibility and the relations between church and state. The medieval ideal of the supremacy of spiritual power. Ambrose has something of the Roman magistrate and something of the medieval pontiff in him. Roman magistrate, medieval pontiff is a good way of putting it. Dawson, of course, credits him with his for his stirring creative praise of God in rhyme, which was to be emulated by many others. Dawson's works consistently espouse the intellectual dynamism of the Latin West. In this sense, he could advance no greater exponent than the Spaniard Prudentius Clemens. Quote, we all know this quote, I think, yet the greatest of the Christian poets was Prudentius, whom Bentley termed the Christian Virgil and Horace. Of all the Christian writers, Prudentius shows the fullest appreciation of the classical tradition in both literary and also its social aspects. Ambrose introduced hymn singing to divine worship, but Prudentius was a far more gifted and expansive poet. It's good to know this to put things in the in order. Ambrose was not as great a poet as Prudentius Clemens, but they dealt with different things. Roman historians, like the British historian, for example, Michael Grant, have noted that the most significant of Prudentius' works, historically, is the two-book poem Against Symmachus, Contra Symmachum, an intellectual polemic against pagan gods, which urges the prominent pagan orator of the day, the city's prefect, Symmachus, to take down the famed pagan altar of victory, which must be expelled from the Senate House. The attack on Symmachus begins when Prudentius refuses the habitual argument that old customs are worthy of reverence because our ancestors have bequeathed them to us. He demonstrates that Rome had brought in new gods with each fresh victory and had not been at all faithful to Rome's paths. While the orator says Rome is ruled by her genius, Prudentius terms this at least a variable genius, since now Rome is the servant of Jesus Christ. This is on the cusp of the changeover from paganism and the influence of Christianity. Intense patriotism breaks forth in verse as Prudentius celebrates the strength of Christian Rome to quell her enemies, a necessary step for peaceful union, paving the way for wider Christianity, as reflected in Prudentius's poem Deus Undique Gentes, God of the Gentiles. More than one of the ancient poets wrote poems about including the Gentiles within the religion and practice of Rome. The dogmatic poem against Symmachus focuses upon the famous display of the golden statue of the goddess of victory with a laurel wreath, which was a trophy from the Pyrrhic War. Symmachus sought restoration of the ancient gods and the altar in an ongoing drama between popes and pagans, like Julian the Apostate, who had restored the altar to spite Christian senators. Ambrose, earlier, had written a letter cautioning the Christian emperor not to waver on this theme. Prudentius had so admired Ambrose's communication that in the year 402, he assumed the Ambrosian task in verse, citing arguments for patriotism, theology, martyrology, and even the early Christian art in Rome's subterranean catacombs. This was a topic, of course, very close to his heart, the whole story of the catacombs and the martyrs who suffered there. Trouble no more the worshippers of Christ, O greatest of the furies. Heresy is disposed of by faith. This was typical of the poetry that he wrote in Contra Symmachum. Heresy is disposed of by Christian faith. He notes that the new Christian Rome, whose advent he had hailed, was destined to inherit the Roman tradition and preserve the old ideal of Roman unity in a changed world. Prudentius has wider appeal, even to the non-religious, we could say, because He invented the stylistic genre of allegory. This is seen in his work, the Psihomahia, that is a psychological battle, an allegorical account of the tense battle for the soul of man. The Psihomahia is a polemical poem which pioneers the first poetical Christian allegory, an original creation which caught the fancy of the Middle Ages and later writers like C.S. Lewis in particular, and inspired much mimesis in literature and art. Epic combats occur between virtues and vices and between Christian faith and paganism, with the combatant following the epic speech tradition. Another outcome presents lust, consigned unsurprisingly to the abyss, as often seen in religious clashes of Renaissance literature, where the good and the worthy must surely win through. You have to get that's on the handout too, and it's a small extract from it. Rather different is Prudentius's hymn 10, for the burial of the dead, in the volume Cathemerimont Liber's Poetic Prayers for Every Day. We've moved now to another source, the Cathemerion. This is an interesting poem in terms of dogma and I think too also decency. For example, particular care must be extended to the bones of the dead, as that same body will rise with agility on Judgment Day. The first great Christian poet also traces such practices as the importance of burial for securing entry into the home of the dead, which is what he says, the home of the dead. And this is, of course, it's a very pagan expression, but we're still on the cusp between two eras. Another concern is the destruction of the corpse by fire, which would definitely hinder resurrection on the day of the Lord. He thinks of every angle posthumously. Overall, we can presume that the office of the dead is one of the most venerable and ancient portions of the breviary. Raby's summary argues that, quote, "It would be true indeed to say that the whole of the poetry of Prudentius Clemens is coloured by this doctrinal intention, that is, to reassure his Catholic readers of the doctrine of the Ascension, but not so intrusively as to undermine or distract from the beauty of the verse." Prudentius, says Raby, is first a Catholic and only in the second place a poet. The hymn For Every Hour in the same volume of the Cathemerion is written in tetrameters. This moves with a solemn measure as the opening poem of the volume in a series of 12 typical hymns covering first the cock crow of the morning, fasting, holy days, etc. The 12-hour day was adopted by the Romans around 291 BC. We know that Ambrose, for one, prayed 7 times a day, although fasting was initially for self-discipline, not penance, and later as preparation for communion. Martin Popus, translator of the Cathemerion, notes, "The hymn for all hours acknowledges Christ the King as the poet's poetic muse." Interesting that. Christ the King becomes the inspiration, the muse for the poet, just as the gods were in the ancient times. He makes this match. But 2 stanzas on from this poem, the speaker utters a much more profound statement of nomenclature in this renowned Christian hymn For All Hours. And I just put the brief statements on the back of your handout. "Of the Father's heart begotten ere the world from chaos rose, he is Alpha, from that fountain all that is and has been flows. He is Omega of all things, Yet to Come, The Mystic, Close. These two famous nomenclatures appear in one of the simple poems within the version of the Hymns for the Christian's Day. Dawson's helpful critique of the Kathimerion collection notes that Christian poetry was learning to make use of the new mythology, that is, Christian mythology, which derived mostly from perhaps works not so familiar to us, that is, poetry from the lesser-known Old Testament legends. The masters of Prudentius were the classical Roman poets, but their mythology was forbidden to a Christian singer. However, mythology and symbolism go hand in hand in the Kathimerion. In fact, most emperors had a vested interest in maintaining polytheism. One could also argue that paganism became aligned reciprocally in terms of the non-Christian with Christianity, the valid marker of nomenclature. The lengthy hymns are more appropriate for personal prayer, since the subject matter is perhaps less appealing than Prudentius's masterful style. Now and again, in reading them, we seem to breathe the air of an earlier time when the faith was young and full of hope, says Raby. When the faith was young and full of hope. Prudentius's outlook as a lifelong 4th century Christian Latin poet envisioned a Christian Rome's capacity for unity and civilization, a timely perspective when in the 4th and 5th centuries the poetical tradition of the West merged with the vitality of Christian culture. Dawson admires Prudentius's gifted poetic leanings and his embrace of Christian poetry inspired by a dedicated faith in Christ. And Dawson sums up, he is certainly the most impressive of the early Christian verse makers and significant to late Latin, early medieval culture and religion. Well, we would all agree with that. Also on your handout, I have some extracts from his very famous autobiographical statement. It's in the form of poetry. I'm not going to read it, it's far too long, but you can have a look at it later if you want to get to know this person better. He was actually a Spanish criminal judge, Prudentius, who obtained very high imperial office. But he does what most people do as they get older. He looks back at what sort of a life he had lived. Shakespeare does that as well. It's a literary stylistic trend that seems to penetrate all literature one way or another, including this Latin literature. He admits in this long poem that he's been very bad and then he's got a bit better, and what good was all the fame and the great career and everything else. So it's a poem that we understand because I think it's something that we all think about from time to time. But you can browse through it later at your leisure. Okay. Italian poets. Paulinus of Nola. I don't know how much you know about him. He was born in 354 and died in 431. Dawson notes early attempts in the West to produce Christian poetry on biblical subjects, drawn from passages by the Roman Virgil. Since the West possessed a lively political tradition, fully assimilated by the new Christian culture. A lively tradition fully assimilated by the new Christian culture. One such outcome emerged with the ascetic conversion of a Lombardian Christian, Paulinus of Nola, near Naples, who was occupied with poetry, missionary and political schemes of Emperor Charles, who appointed him grammar master in the royal school. Paulinus later committed to a saintly life of exemplary tolerance under his guardian Saint Felix, and became a figure of ascetic imitation and contemplation through oral tradition. He's very, very famous in Italy, Paulinus of Nola, Saint Felix, his guardian, but particularly in the United States. within Italian communities as well. They have big celebrations on the feast day of St. Felix, processions, etc., as they do in Italy. Paulinus, on the literary side, there are two things that we give Paulinus credit for. But he didn't know it at the time. We know now. Paulinus actually wrote the first poetic elegy on literary record. This shy little man, totally religious, spending a lot of his time in church. He wrote the first poetic elegy, a mourning song. And he wrote it to comfort a Christian couple's loss of their young son, a longing well felt by Paulinus and his Spanish wife, Teresa, who were also bereft of their only child as well. Paulinus's attempt at a wedding poem is also the first documented Christian epithalamion, or wedding poem, composed for the nuptials of a couple called Julianus and Titia. Unlike the classic era, mythology has no place in this divergence of traditional song. The sensual gods are absent from the ceremony, and their long-standing roles now submit to Christian virtues in Paulinus's Carmen 25, and his use of an imagistic opposition to detract the audience from the old beliefs and ancient worship. The strains from the pagan duo of Venus and Cupid are finally redundant, thanks to Paulinus, and the laurels of this prototype Christian marriage are graced by peace, modesty, and piety. And this is stressed and exemplified by the poet in his quote, Virgo Puer Christi, Virgo Puella Dei, the young Virgin Mother Mary, now embodying considerable cultural and didactic sway in an image far more remote from classical hymnals to the gods. Christopher Dawson finds common themes in the poems of Prudentius and Paulinus, demonstrating that the cult of the martyrs transformed into the religious social institution of local saints, manifesting civic piety and patriotism, with the city-state finding a new cohesion through cult saints. In this case, with Paulinus, St. Felix is honoured with a basilica, a representative garden of the city, guardian of the city, and carnivals, since he imparts an enshrined glory through the worship of harmonious Christian community. Dawson stresses the fact that the cult of the martyrs and saints became a social institution. And we all are familiar with this. If we've been to schools, Catholic schools, where there tended to be a saint's day every week and we're always reminded about it. And also celebrating saints and particular days of saints in churches, dressing up the church with extra flowers and things. So this actually started, this cult of saints and people going, the community going to saints and cathedrals with the name of the local saint, started at the time of Paulinus of Nola near Naples. And we still see some of it today. Finally, there was a significant female author of the literary period under review, Fautonia Proba, a 4th-century poet who modelled her Christian verses on the great Virgil's classic works and termed herself a prophet. The Homeric style cento was adopted by this convert daughter of a Roman pagan consul. She converted, the father didn't. The cento as a poetic form is best described as a patchwork literary composition, uplifting lines from other sources to simulate what we would say a verse collage, where you put bits and pieces together and they create some identifiable image. It's done in art and it's done in embroidery, quilt making, things like that. But she did it with words, right? As such, her linguistic technique reassembled a close reading of Virgil's classical texts in her 700-line poem, honouring the Christian context of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, whose creation of the seasons emulates Virgil's Georgics, one of his finest volumes. Prober was the first Christian poet to focus exclusively on the book of Genesis. In her epic poem, Vigilianus Laudibus Christi, composed to teach children religious history and rhyme, although the poem is not only didactic. Centos require technical skill in handling of meter and verb form. Prober has been classified, and this is a big label, and this has come from research done in Central Europe and Eastern Europe in particular, where Prober is greatly followed. Prober has been classified as perhaps the most influential Christian Latin poet of late antiquity on the cusp of the Middle Ages. In her preface, Prober's purpose, she calls her preface, she castigates false leaders who have violated peace in bloodthirsty desires to rule. But she seeks poetic guidance as well. Quote, "Now, all-powerful God, take, I pray, my sacred song, that I, Prober, the prophet, might reveal its secrets. That I might reveal its secrets, take my soul." It's like she wants God to process the soul and then emphasize in some way to her what she should be spreading as the word. "Be at my side, Lord, set my thoughts straight as I tell how Virgil sang the offices of Christ." Originality was not highly prized back then. Listen to the next bit. I had to put it in. Saint Jerome decried the dangers of pagan texts and belittled the cento poetic genre as pieces of literature. Even though the great Virgil had drawn, that stolen we could say, had drawn heavily from Homer's epic compositions. Dawson, of course, we all know, promotes, quite logically, Saint Jerome as the unsurpassed master of Latin among the fathers of the church. He was writing in his late years in Bethlehem when Prober came on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Derogatory of her literary skills, Jerome corresponded with, not quite sure how this happened, corresponded with Paulinus of Nola, informing him that, quote, "an old chatterbox in Jerusalem wanted to teach scriptures before even understanding them," end of quote. And thus, Pope Gelasius declared Prober the Laudibus Christi an, what? Apocryphal text. One never to be read. But during the Middle Ages, her intriguing cento resonated as a dynamic educational tool in a convergence of literature, learning, and language. And Giovanna Boccaccio in the Renaissance listed Prober in his volume Famous Women for her perception that the Roman poet Virgil's poems could serve as a base model for the history of both the Old and New Testaments. In summary, Dawson singles out the reconciliation of Christianity and the classical tradition in the 4th to the 5th centuries, evident in patristic culture and Latin Christian poetry's profound influence on the formation of the European mind. The poetry of the church was such a characteristic, and creative writing achievement of early Western Christianity, and it bore such fruit late in the vernacular literature of the modern world. The vast body of Christian poetry was built up by the labor of more than 1,000 years. Whether it be St. Patrick's Old Irish poetry or Dante's glorious divine vision in the comedy, Christian poetry confirmed man's need for belief, consolation, and, of course, redemption. Thank you.
That was Dr. Nora Leasis with Christopher Dawson's response to culture and religion in Christian Latin poetry. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the theme Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit creadio.org.au.